It's been a wonderful experience, but within the last few years, it's also been a bitter experience because I've also had to watch them all pass away. And that, I think, for me, you know, I'm getting a little emotional now talking about it.
This is SITREP, the New York City Department of Veterans Services podcast, where we aim to inform and inspire by bringing you the stories of New York City veterans, military service members, their families, and civilian supporters. I'm your host, Gabe Ramos, U.S. Marine Corps veteran and Deputy Press Secretary here at DVS. On today's episode, we chat with Joe Bello, Navy veteran and longtime veteran advocate in New York City. Joe tells us about the legacy of the Vietnam veterans who mentored him after leaving the military, and about collaborating with government and community partners to serve a calling greater than himself. Enjoy the show. All right, so we're here with Joe Bello. Joe Bello is a Navy veteran serving 11 years on active and reserve duty. He sits on the NYC Veterans Advisory Board and, of course, is a longtime advocate for the military and veteran community right here in New York City. Joe, welcome.
Thank you.
Really glad to have you here. So I guess we should probably just start with the kind of beginning of your military experience. I know you grew up here in New York City. So just talk to me a little bit about kind of what led you to join the military in the first place and just about a little bit about your background.
Sure. Okay. So as we were saying, born and raised in New York, get to high school, parents divorce, hated high school, decided I wanted to do something different. I'd never left New York, you know? So I said, oh, you know what? I'm going to join the Army. And so I went to the recruiter, and he wasn't there. And the Navy guy told me, hey, you want to travel the world, right? You don't just want to be stationed in one place. I said, yeah. He says, the Navy. And I said, the Navy. And there so that's go. How I wound up in the Navy.
Now, and, did you have any kind of legacy of military folks in your family, or were you kind of an isolated?
No, I was kind of an isolated. You know, I wanted to do something different. I just felt like, you know, look, I wanted to travel, figure I'd save some money, gain a skill.
Right.
You know, and so I thought, you know, those were the interesting reasons to go in, and I went in pretty right after high school. Same thing as a previous speaker. I actually, my parents had to sign me in.
Mm.
So, you know, I graduated in June of 84, and by July, I was already at boot camp in Orlando, Florida.
Right.
Which is now gone.
And so now, obviously, your parents had to kind of help you enlist. How did they feel about it, though? What was their reaction when you told them this was your plan?
Well, you know, the 80s were a different time. So we weren't really into anything at that time. You know, Reagan was the president. So mm-hmm. it was like, okay, you know, I mean, if this is what you really want to do, I'm not going to say they were overtly happy about it, but it was kind of like, all right, you know, so they, you know, my mom signed the papers and off I went.
And so you go to the off the boot camp, go to your kind of A school. What is that like? Talk me through that experience.
Well, believe it or not, my recruiter lied to me, so I wound up initially. Yeah,
recruiters lie.
Yeah, right. Go figure. So yeah. I wound up in basically learning how to like drive a ship, bust rust, you know, things like that.
Right.
And so by the time I got to my first command, I was already like, well, I'm going to have to retake the ASVAB. I'm going to have to redo all these. You know, get a higher score. So I wound up kind of doing things a little ass backwards, so to speak. So by the time I got to Norfolk, to my first ship, you know, I retook the ASVAB. And then they were like, okay, well, you're going to have to extend the year if you want to. And I was like, fine. So I wound up going to A school like thereafter in Meridian, Mississippi. So, you know, and then came back to the same ship. And that ship was a new cruiser. So it was constantly it was called USS South Carolina, CGN 37. And we always used to say the CGM was constantly going nowhere because it was always deployed.
Yeah.
So, you know, I did two med cruises, a North Atlantic, Gitmo. I mean, we traveled on that ship. So.
And for the folks at home who don't know what a med cruise is?
Oh, well, it's basically, it's a deployment.
Yep.
And, you know, you're making a deployment and you're basically in the Mediterranean. You know, we operated in the Mediterranean and, you know, you hit a bunch of different ports. But for the times I was in, we usually followed the Russians.
Right.
You know, we'd follow them up to like kind of the Black Sea and they'd follow us. And, you know, I was there in 85 for the TWA hijacking in Beirut.
Mm.
So we wound up spending like 90 days off the coast. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of what med cruises entailed.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Marine Corps recall. Well, I went on a West Pack. So you kind of tour the West Pacific.
Yeah.
So,
I've done a mini pack on one of my, you know, so I definitely know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So how are you finding at this point? How old are you around this time? Like early 20s, right?
Yeah, 19, 20, yeah.
So how are you finding that as kind of your first experience out of New York City, away from home, around kind of a new group of folks you've never really interacted with before?
It was kind of a culture shock. It was kind of like, you know, you go to basic training and, you know, I'm meeting all these people that just are from different places and different spaces and I have no idea, you know, and they're... And so it was kind of a culture shock, you know, and everybody's like, you got an accent. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, so it was interesting. And then you get to the first command. And obviously the first time you go out to sea, that wasn't pleasant, mm-hmm. you know, because you don't have no sea legs.
Right.
So, you know, the ship is rocking and rolling and you're like, you know, everywhere. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I would say my first major deployment, it was 9 months. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was definitely a, experience, but by the time we came back, I was already I think an E3, and I would already I was ready to go to A school right after that. So right. Everything kind of like, you know, I was starting to move that way.
You kind of started getting your groove there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then I want to kind of flash forward, because I know you went from active duty to reserve duty. Well, what went into that thought process?
Well, I was basically active reserves. So, you know, I was a reserve recruiter in my last tour. So, you know, I was right here in the Bronx, mm-hmm. you know, at Fort Schuyler. So, you know, for me, it was 11 years active duty. I mean, you know, but again, that last part being active duty reserves, where I was just basically recruiting for the reserves.
Got it.
And so, you know, and I took that because they initially had offered me active duty recruiting. And I remember what it was like when I went and I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I'd rather meet with people who have already gotten out, mm-hmm. and I'm not lying to them. It's just 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year. That's what I'm selling you. You an extra paycheck, and that's it.
Got it.
So, you know, it made the mission a lot easier for me.
So it's folks who have already left active duty or in that process of leaving active duty?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Like, you know, basically if they're coming back and they're looking to make a little extra money.
Right.
And they want, like, if they've been in for a number of years and they want to keep that time while they're building towards retirement. And, you know, like I said, we offered them basically, you know, 2 weeks active duty a year, mm-hmm. 1 week in a month, you know, and you still had the camaraderie.
So yeah,
you still
sells had itself.
The, yeah, exactly. So that's exactly what it did. Sold itself.
And gives folks kind of a soft landing as sure. they're transitioning. Yeah. So when you kind of officially took the uniform off, what was, because I know that wasn't necessarily your choice, right? So how did that come about?
No, so I developed asthma. And, you know, at that time, you know, the military, it wasn't like after 9/11 where they give you an inhaler and say, keep it going.
Right.
You know, they basically, you know, I'd gone down to Bethesda and they had turned around and said, well, okay, we're going to separate you. And I'm like, I've already got 11 years in. Like, you know, I was looking to do a career.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of tough to swallow. That was really kind of a, you know, it was really a bitter pill. It was like, you know, sure. I felt kind of betrayed, you know, it was really hurt.
Right.
You know, and I really wasn't sure what to do because, you know, my folks had moved to Orlando. You know, I was like living with my brother here in Queens. So I wasn't really sure like, well, okay, what am I going to do? But, you know, and again, getting out in 95, it was very different. You know, there wasn't
of course.
Like the veterans today. So, and there wasn't all these programs and, you know, DVS was not DVS. It was the Mayor's Office of Veterans Affairs.
Nope.
So it was a very different experience. Most of the veterans in the space were World War II or Vietnam. Mm-hmm. In fact, most of my mentors wound up being Vietnam vets. So, you know, I got out and, you know, I went to look for a job right away. First things first. All right, I'm going to go find a job. So, you know, and unfortunately, I wasn't getting hired.
Mm.
And so I just happened to go to this one interview and the employer says to me, you know, you've got this experience, but you have no education.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you ever thought about going back to school? I was like, no, you know, but it kind of put something, a seed in there that I was like, you know what, maybe take a look, you know, because I'd been out of school for so long. So I wasn't really kind of sure, like, you know, is college going to be right for me? What am I going to do?
Of course. Yeah.
And sure enough, you know, being older than most of my classmates and everything, it was, you know, I was more focused. So, you know, I was able to kind of really get through it. Mm. It was, you know, I actually thrived in some of it, you know, and then I started off in CUNY, which I absolutely loved. And then I wound up in NYU where I graduated from. So
kind of taking a couple steps back. So sure. when you first find out that you've gotten this kind of diagnosis of asthma, they're going to kind of force you out. At what point do you start? Obviously, all right. So you're bitter about it. They're kind of cutting your career short. But at what point did you say, all right, now I got to kind of figure my next step out?
Well, for me, it really didn't happen that way, only because they didn't put me out, so to speak. They put me on temporary disability retired.
Okay.
So I had that 5-year window.
Got it.
So every year I was going to Groton where they were giving me, you know, a checkup.
Right.
And then, you know, but again, at that time, I had already started school. I was starting a family.
Got it.
You know, so, I was kind of moving in that way.
So it wasn't necessarily like they gave you a diagnosis. All right, 90 days, we'll see it. They eased the process a little bit.
Yeah. But I mean, like I said, it was bitter because, again, all of a sudden I was not on active duty anymore.
Naturally,
and
yeah.
I was basically home. But, you know, again, after not being able to find work and deciding, look, I'm going to go to school. You know, again, I still had those where I'd get that letter every year. Oh, show up at Groton. We're going to give you your appointment. And it was my junior year at NYU and coming to the end of the junior year and my senior year, I get my 5-year letter and they're like, okay, we're going to send you. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to go to DC for my board hearing. Mm. No, we're going to send you to San Diego.
Uh-huh.
So they sent me to San Diego and it was the wildest thing. It was just 2000.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, okay, you know, they're going to put me out. And they were like, oh, do you want to come back in? And I'm like, what, are you kidding me? Like, you know, and I had to think about it because at first I was like, yeah.
Mm.
But then I realized, wait a minute. Whoa, I'm a junior, almost of a senior at NYU.
Right.
I already have a family. I'm already with somebody. And I realized that door had closed.
Yeah. So you kind of already far enough removed to start thinking, all right, maybe it's time to just close that chapter of my life.
Yeah. So I said, you know, thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah.
And so they just basically gave me my severance check and we just parted ways.
So did you still kind of harbor some kind of bitterness at this point? Would you say?
I wouldn't say bitterness, but like resentment, you know, I would say there was some resentment there. There was definitely some longing.
Right.
Like, you know, I remember like I could have went into the New York Guard and they were like, there was all these things and I was like, maybe I could do that. And then I said, you know, every time it got to like, no.
Yeah.
Like, no. You know, it's like the door closed. Let it close.
Right.
You know, keep moving. Right. So that's basically, you know.
Why do you think you were still trying to, or why do you think you were so reluctant to completely let it go at first?
Well, I think because of all the years that I had put in. You know, 11 years is a long time. You know, right. I was already past a decade. So I already knew, like, you know, I had just made E6.
Yep.
So, you know, I'm thinking, oh, you know, I'll make chief and master chief, you know, I'll be able to have a 20-year career. And so there was always that, like the what I envisioned in the outer years. And then that just didn't happen. And it just kind of, you know, flipped out. So.
Right. So it took a little bit of time to kind of come to that realization that,
yeah, it did.
That original plan that you had isn't going to materialize. It's time to figure out the next thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because I never thought that they'd offer me to come back in. And it was like, you know, you got to be kidding me. Like, really?
Right.
You know, and for, I'd say a few hours, because, you know, obviously my wife wasn't with me at the time, but for a few hours, I was
thought
like,
about it.
But I want to do it.
Yeah.
And then
it's like when your ex-girlfriend calls.
Yeah. And it was like, oh yeah. You know, and like, and then I remember talking to her on a payphone in San Diego, because there was no cell phones really at that time. It's pagers.
Right.
And I said, what am I doing? Like, no, you know, like, no, it's not going to happen. So.
Yeah. So, 2000, you're in your junior, senior year.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, how did you kind of decide what you wanted to study and kind of go about thinking about what your next step was going to be?
Well, it was funny because my dad was an accountant and my mom was an HR person. So I always thought business.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually started at, LaGuardia Community College doing business administration and I hated it.
Right.
It was like, what the hell am I? This is bullshit. You know, I hate it. It was just like not for me.
Yeah.
And so when I got accepted into NYU, I decided to do something different. Like take a plunge. Like what was I interested in? And at the time, I was already doing advocacy for a few years and I was running with a lot of the Vietnam vets.
Mm.
And I decided, you know what? Communication studies looks good. You know, public relations, speech. And I thought, you know, I'm going to do that. And I jumped in and it was the best thing I could have done. I loved it. I thrived in it. The classes were great, you know, and it was the best move I could have made.
What did you love about it?
pretty much everything. I mean, just able, like, to be able to write. Like, I didn't know, like, that I wanted to write. I just didn't know how to write.
Right.
And there was classes that were teaching me how to do that. And again, there were speech classes. So, you know, we'd have to stand in front of a podium or not stand in front of a podium. So, I mean, the classes were so interesting, you know, and I really fell in love with the major. It was really good.
Yeah. And so you mentioned you had kind of dipped your toes in the advocacy waters. Talk a little bit about that. Obviously, you said your mentors were World War II, Korea, Vietnam veterans.
Well, mostly all Vietnam vets, you know. I mean, so yeah, when I got out, again, it was the landscape in New York City was very different in terms of what the veterans were. And, you know, the first thing they tell me is, in fact, it was so funny. I didn't even know where the regional office was because it's not where it was, where it is today. Mm. It was on 7th Avenue by 23rd Street. And come to find out that it had been there since World War II.
Wow.
So, you know, the first person I run into is a Vietnam vet. And sure enough, they're like, oh, it's here. And they're starting, and we're having conversations. And, you know, and then I'm starting to kind of run with some of them. And I'm going to, like, different boroughs for meetings. And, okay, what is it we want to get done?
Now, are these policy-specific meetings? Or is it more just, like, VFW, American Legion meetings? Or
yeah, a little of both. Okay. A little of both. Like, you know, there was always a group of people who they wanted to get something done. You know, but at the time, it was a very different... Again, it was very different in the space. So it was like, okay, how do you go about doing that? There wasn't a veterans committee in the city council like there is today. Mm-hmm. You know, basically everything ran through governmental operations committee. So it was a very different landscape. But what I found was learning through them about, you know, how to do certain things, who to network with, how to communicate.
Right.
That really became kind of like, and, you know, working with people like Ed Daniels, who was one of my biggest mentors, you know, he's a Vietnam vet, started Incarcerated Veterans Consortium, dragging me to the jails to meet vets, you know, and I'm like, what am I doing in a jail? You know, but we're having conversations with them about services and benefits. And then at the time, I had started working at LaGuardia at their Veterans Upward Bound program, which was basically college prep for veterans. So I started seeing, and at the time, you know, we weren't seeing a lot of vets because, again, this is prior to 2001. But we were seeing like a steady, you know, they'd go off to active duty and then they'd come home. And like me, they wanted to go to college, you know, and... they didn't have the skill set for math, reading, and writing, so they'd go through the program. So, you know, I was kind of seeing vets on both ends of the spectrum and, you know, started to kind of move.
What do you think that you connected with so strongly? Because obviously we're talking early 2000, and that's kind of been essentially your main thing since then, right? So your whole life has been all about advocacy and trying to improve this community by any means necessary. So I'm curious in those kind of initial connections that you made initially, you know, whether it's going to the jail or these VFW American Legion meetings, what was it about that process that sparked a fire in you?
Well, I think part of the process was the camaraderie.
Yeah.
I think the other part of the process was learning what was going on the ground. So, you know, there were people and names that were being said to me that, like, I didn't know who they were. So, for example, Angel Almedina. And I'm like, who is this guy? You know, and you come to find out, Vietnam vet, Puerto Rican, came home to East Harlem, and he was a junkie, in essence. You know, he really was. But he supported the vets in that community, and he, like, social justice issues and stuff. And you really, like, you begin to see, like, I think for me, what I began to see was when the Vietnam vets say that nobody supported them when they came home, they weren't kidding.
Right.
There really was. And so, like, all the mechanisms and the groups that were in existence that back then, you know, were really there to support each other.
Yeah.
So the camaraderie was the big one, but also seeing the social justice aspect of it, Black Veterans for Social Justice, Commonwealth, you know, I mean, these are Vietnam vets who started setting up, you know, homeless places for, you know, their fellow Vietnam vets to live in. They fought for Borden Avenue, the creation of Borden Avenue under Dinkins and Koch. I mean, you know, and that's what I started to really learn. And without realizing it, and I've only kind of realized it within the last several years, I've also kind of been a watcher of history, or like I've gained all that. They've kind of passed it on.
Right.
And so it's weird because I actually got into the advocacy because I always used to think, and again, before 9/11, who's going to advocate for me?
Right.
You know, in my generation, if I don't like start doing something, because I didn't see anybody behind me. Mm. And so, you know, that kind of pushed me into that as well. So it's been a wonderful experience, but within the last few years, it's also been a bitter experience because I've also had to watch them all pass away.
Right.
And that, I think, for me, you know, I'm getting a little emotional now talking about it. For me, that's been the hardest thing because, you know, these guys were really like, I mean, they were in the community on the ground level doing the work day in and day out. And with very little, you know, resources from the city, resources from council, resources anywhere. Mm. So, you know, that was a biggie.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, the way that you connected with them kind of on a personal level, but also, you know, they served to kind of, as you said, they were your mentors, but they also inspired you. They showed you what was possible, right? So you were on the ground, you were seeing the reality of the situation, and you saw folks who came home and rather than just throwing their hands up and saying, well, you know, nobody's going to take care of us, screw it. Yeah. They actually went out and said, no, we're going to take care of ourselves. We're going to take care of our community.
And it was interesting being on the ground level too, because, you know, you'd look at like a federal policy, there'd be a law that would be passed. And what I began to see, even with the city council stuff, you know, every now and then they would pass something. You see how it trickles down, you know, and how it trickles down into the community and how it affects them, whether it's a benefit or not so much of a benefit.
Right.
You know? And so I started learning a lot of policy that way as well.
Right.
So
you were seeing kind of the human, the human element of kind of policies, right? So folks, they tend to see government policies as just kind of, oh, it's that's over there. That has nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. But there are tangible benefits on a personal level that oftentimes folks don't even realize that they're being affected by these things that are going on.
Well, that's what makes it so funny. Like today, when I look at it today, you look at all these programs and services, and immediately most people think, oh, OIF, OEF, you know, Gulf War on Terror. But when you look and you start looking at a policy, like who really is using these services? It's the older vets.
Right.
It's the older vets that are using the services because they are more aware of it. And right now they're in that position where they kind of need it or it's available. So I'm going to use it.
Right.
And so, you know,
that's
been interesting to watch as well.
Less of a reluctancy too, I think, you know, as you start getting older, I mean, I'm, you know,
mid-30s,
but even beyond that, you start saying, oh, wait, this is there. I it's available to me. I did kind of something to earn it. Why am I not going to?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of, like you look at the World War II vets and, you know, even some of the Vietnam vets, they didn't use the VA, you know, they got their own healthcare, they whatever, but as they've gotten older, they're coming into the VA. They're coming. Yeah. Same thing with like, you know, what's going on with the VSOs, with the legacy groups, you know, the Legion, the Post. You know, the VFW, they're gaining members right now. Mm. You know, we know it's only going to be for a little bit of a time, but a lot of those veterans that never got involved in it are what, you know, like I like to say, they're coming home.
Yeah. So, talk to me a little bit about kind of as you've really kind of started getting or making advocacy kind of a bit priority for you. At what point did it kind of become, you know, a daily part of your work and routine and how you kind of started working your way through, you know, trying to find relationships with folks in city government and city agencies and nonprofits. Talk to me through that.
Well, I'd always been starting to do that. So I, you know, one of the first things I did when I started like going to the council is, you know, I worked with Jim Otto, who's now the Staten Island Borough President. Mm-hmm. So I started working with him because he put a bill to put the missing MIA POW flag. Simple bills, but you know, like you do it and you're working with them. And, you know, Mike Nelson was another one. So you started working like through, there were small bills. It wasn't anything huge or anything like that. And really the fights seemed to become, or the battle was to try to get MOVA to have more funding. We were always trying to get MOVA to have more funding because, you know, it was just a 4 or 5 person operation with a director. It wasn't even a
commissioner.
It wasn't even a commissioner.
MOVA, obviously, I think most folks know, but who don't know, it's Mayor's Office of Veterans Affairs.
Yeah. So, it was funny, and it gotten so bad. So Mike Handy was the director, and then Clarice joined us, but at one point, they stopped doing even a newsletter. Mm. So I picked it up. I started doing a newsletter. And that's kind of like, I was like, okay, if they're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. Like, somebody's got to do it, because nobody knows what's going on in the boroughs. Nobody's communicating with each other. Mm. So, it started rolling like that. It started really going. But I was always in the space because, again, I was working at LaGuardia and the Veterans Office. So, I was always working with CUNY Central as well.
Yep.
Even though they didn't at the time have a university director, so to speak. And so then for me, the big year really moving through was 2013. So I should say 2012, I made the decision, I'm going to leave LaGuardia. I was like, I'm going to leave LaGuardia because I thought, there was all these candidates running for mayor. And I'm like, look, somebody's going to do veterans this coming forward, right. This year. And, so my friend Ed Daniels, myself, a few other people, we had written a white paper, a position paper. I remember Ruben Diaz Sr. actually had me give a policy speech at Lincoln Hospital for it. I met with like pretty much all the candidates, I think, except for Wiener. I actually had written Bill Thompson's veteran platform. Mm. So, and I really thought we're going to get something done this time around. And I met with obviously the mayor as well. And when he won, I thought, okay, so what do we want? And right. So speaking, what I've learned too is you have to work with others.
Of course.
And so, you're working with the people like a John Rowan or things like that. And it was like, okay, we're going to try to get a department.
Right.
And we had already gotten the director to a commissioner level under the Bloomberg administration, but we were like, we're going to try to get a department. And that's really where the battle for like 2013 to 14 really went in.
So you saw the opportunity of a potential new incoming administration as kind of regardless of maybe where they stood on the ideological spectrum, that this was an opportunity for you to really get some effective changes for the veteran military community here in New York City.
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember too. So, we were talking city government, but what was happening on the veteran side of the house? You saw we get to 2008, and we have the financial crash. But within that time, we're starting to see Michigan Continues, mm-hmm. Team Red, White, and Blue. You're starting to see these groups pop up.
Right.
And so, going back even to 2004 when IAVA first popped up and they were OpTruth prior. So you kind of like saw like, okay, something's happening with the right. younger vets and they're starting to come into the space and nobody, including the VA, was ready for them. Mm. So it was kind of like, so you have that going on one side. And so by the time we get to 2013, obviously there's like all this synergy and energy and, the Obama administration wants to, kind of reduce homelessness. And so it was kind of like, we need a department, we need something, we need more.
Right.
We lucked out in the partners that we had in government that were willing to do it. And so it really became an inside outside game.
Mm. So talk a little bit about how you then worked with those partners inside government. How did you go start leveraging those relationships and kind of moving the thing forward?
Well, I mean, first of all, they had to have, in speaking to Councilman Ulrich, who was the chair of the Veterans Committee at the time,
yep.
He was very supportive of it and he understood the arguments for it. And it didn't hurt that he had a lot of veterans in his district as well. Mm. So, there was an argument to be made. So we started leveraging like those conversations and then talking to other council members. And, at the time, then, we were on New York One.
Right.
I mean, we were doing quite a bit and we were really starting to push it now.
Any opportunity you could just to get the word out.
Yeah. And we knew, but we also knew like, look, there was other battles to go too. Like right. not just DVS, but the Veterans Advisory Board needed to be revamped. We were talking about the veteran courts and their rise. So we needed them here in all five boroughs. We didn't have them in five boroughs. We only had them in two. So, I mean, there was like all these battles but the priority was getting the department. Get the department, and then the other stuff will kind of fall in place because you will have, and you can make that argument.
Yeah.
So
you get that win. The department is signed into law.
Sure.
How does your outlook now shift? So now this kind of thing that you fought for you know, right around two, almost 3 years has kind of come to fruition. How do you then shift your, how do you direct your advocacy now?
Well, for me, I thought I was going back to work.
Really?
You know, I figured, look, you know, I've, well, you know,
I'm done here.
I figured, look, we're done. You know, we got it. You know, I started to apply for positions and, you know, in for work. And I thought, all right. And then all of a sudden we're doing the Veterans Advisory Board stuff. We're doing the veteran court stuff. We're doing the, and all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I'm not working. Like I'm working, but I'm like all over the place now. Right. And then, you know, I started being asked like, oh, will you be on this board? Oh, will you be on that board? Oh, you're going to be the co-chair for this thing. Oh, you join us on the CCOC. And all of a sudden I'm like realizing, okay, like I'm in these kind of leadership positions, but I've never considered myself that kind of person.
Yeah.
I'm kind of the everyman, the working man, like, and you see what's going on the ground. So that's been kind of a interesting.
So it's been a little bit of a shift for you.
Yeah. Because again, it's one thing to have conversations with, let's say, the commissioner or a councilman, but it's very different from, you know, being at a post and hearing about, you know, I can't pay rent or right. I need food stamps or something like that, you know, or there's a problem going on, you know, and that's a very different conversations.
Yeah. How do you feel you're most effective?
I think for me, being a bridger on both ends. So it's like I tell people, I'm a Gulf War I vet, even though I always consider myself a Cold War vet. But I'm a Gulf War vet. Mm. So I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam vets when I was little, you know, and a kid. But I'm young enough to know the OIF, OEF vets. You know, I don't sit on one. I kind of feel like I'm in the middle. And that's kind of how I see myself in the space. So I'm kind of like, I remember the history, but I see what's happening now. And so, you know, I'm always mindful. History repeats itself.
Right.
You know, and I've had conversations with Vietnam vets who tell me, like, hey, we had all these non-for-profits and the Vietnam veteran leadership and all this other stuff. And then, you know, we get to the 80s and it's all gone. So I'm always mindful, like, hey, you know, is history going to repeat itself? So again, for me, it's just like being a watcher and being in the middle, like just keeping an eye. You know, if you have to say something, make the point. Mm-hmm. Try to be respectful if you can about it. You know, you understand people will not like it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes those things have to be said. So, you know, I think that's the most important thing.
How do you ensure that the message you're communicating aligns with the kind of hopes, expectation, needs of the community?
Well, I think for me, it's important that we at least be honest with each other. I think that's the biggest for me. If I'm wrong, I've always told people, if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. tell me I'm wrong and explain to me why I'm wrong. I'll be the first person to say, okay, I was wrong. But if I'm not, then we need to have a conversation about how we all move forward together on it. So I don't necessarily, like as I've gotten older, I don't necessarily disagree like with what an organization is necessarily trying to do. I disagree about how they go about and do it. And I think that's the where I'm at now. So it's like, if there's a point to be made, you know, make the point, like, you know, we are stakeholders. Mm. We need to move together.
Yeah. Well,
if you want to move by yourself, then that's fine. But let's be clear about what you want to do versus what the community is doing.
Well, I think that speaks to like, you know, kind of politics in general. So,
yeah.
You know, folks on one side, they have an idea of how to solve an issue, and folks on the other side have an idea. And it's all about, it's a battle of ideas, getting together in a room, having those conversations and doing what you can to move.
Yeah. And I'm always mindful, even with the OIF, OEF vets. You know, you look at it, I was just saying this before, we've been at war now for 18 years in the forever war. You're looking at two generations. So even within them, it's a very different mindset. So if you served from 01 to, like, let's say 11, 12, you're having children now, you're into work, you're married, you're on the back end, you're in school thinking about maybe entrepreneurs. It's a very separate, different mindset going on.
Even amongst the post.
Even amongst,
call.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, we're just about wrapping up. I was curious, obviously you're pretty attuned to what folks in the community are doing, what their experiences are like, and obviously you act as that kind of bridge between generations. But I'm curious, if you had one thing you could you could tell every New York City veteran or service member, what would that be?
Well, for me, it's always don't believe the hype. you're your best advocate. You know, one of the things in the military is you're used to having a personnel clerk, a dispersing clerk, you know, and somebody who's handling your finances, your money, your paperwork. That's you now. Mm. So you have to be your best advocate. And that's not to say don't trust others, but you have to be aware. And so I think for me, that's the most important thing. A lot of people, you know, they go into the service and they have this one job and then they're out. And a lot of them don't know how to deal with finances, don't know how to deal with, like, you know, the bureaucracy of not just the VA, but the city government.
Right.
So you have to be your best advocate. And I think that's always been my advice. Like, don't look at the optics, look at what's in front of you. What can you do and be your best advocate? Go for the help. You know, don't turn it away, but make sure you're doing what's right by you.
What about to the folks who maybe don't have a direct connection to the military?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd say thank you for the years of support. You know, to anybody that's ever supported a veteran or family member or anything, I always, you know, thank you. I just think that realize that there is still a war going on, that people still are dying and being killed, and that, you know, there still are challenges, and we can do what we can do, but it makes things better when they're with us.
I know I said that was the last question, but I'm curious. What has been the most rewarding part of the work that you've done over the 20, 30 years?
Yeah, 22 years. I think for me, the most rewarding part has been getting things done, watching people grow, and being part of, like, something bigger than myself. I think that's been my biggest, having looked at it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what's made me really happy. And being, like I said, being a part of something bigger than myself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're part of that thing bigger than ourselves. And I'm
let me say one more thing before I let you go.
Please.
I would not have been able to do any of this without my wife, who is a vet herself.
Of course.
And so, you know, my wife Vicky has been my rock. And, you know, you can only imagine all the nights of running around, the late night diner dinners, City Hall, back and forth, all five boroughs without her.
I believe it. So. Well, we're all extremely grateful to her and to you and the rest of the Bello family. So thanks so much for doing this, Jeff.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Cheers.